alcoholic. It's good to know what I am today. Spent a long time trying to figure that one out. And I'd really like to thank Billy for asking me to come here and help celebrate his 10-year anniversary. And for the group being here. You know, this is a good time to meet, 6 p.m. on Sunday night. For me, I couldn't think of a better place to be right now. Been in an AA meeting, not just speaking, but on any night, it, for me, is the best place I can be in an AA meeting, because it just makes the world around me go so much better. Can't tell you how much better it goes. And I'm also a believer that you have to take the steps, and when you take the steps, the meetings become a whole different place. And we said a long time ago, you can't recover just off the fellowship. We didn't say stop going to meetings. You know, we said there's a little bit more to it. We offer sponsorship and steps and home group. You know, but an alcoholic has a learning deficiency, and they hear what they're going to hear despite what you say. I got it too. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me for a long time. Till I got here, and I was hopeless enough that I allowed an alcoholic with a solution to diagnose me with what problem that I have and offer me a solution that has pretty much worked since May 5th, 1987. And I have not good news for some people. I haven't tried anything else, and for other people, that's bad news. I found everything that I've needed here and more, and AA, I believe, in my experience, is sufficient within itself. And my story kind of speaks to you about that. I'll just cut to the chase. First time that I got drunk was 13 years old. And it was with a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I drank the whole thing. In a company of other people. I can't remember if they had a bottle or not, but I know I drank it enough to get physically sick, so I drank my fair share of it that day. So I always say now that I think that if you are 13 years old and drank a bottle of Boone's Farm of any kind, then they should have a warning label inside the bottle now. You may be a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a pretty common story around here. I was a kid that had a lot of problems, didn't know what they were. People around me didn't seem to know how to help me. And things just seemed to get worse all the time. So my father sent me to a school psychologist, and for the first time in my life I got misdiagnosed and I didn't know it. And the school psychologist was a good person and meant well and was certainly there to help people, but he misdiagnosed me with an emotional illness. I don't suffer from an emotional illness. It's a symptom of my problem. The greater problem I have is what AA has taught me, is I suffer from a spiritual illness. That's only a symptom. And when you treat a symptom, the problem never goes away. And I had to learn that the hard way. And what he told my parents, and I admitted to him that I had used some non-habit forming marijuana and some of the other stuff that were coming out of the late 60s, I was curious. After that Boone's Farm, it made everything real curious. And he said that I suffered from a low self-esteem. And if I could gain self-esteem, then I would be able to solve my problem, which was to gain some self-confidence, because I wasn't doing real well in school. In fact, I was flunking out. In fact, when I started the first grade, I was flunking out. Somehow I made it to that grade. Okay? He said if I got some self-confidence in myself, and any time that you give self as a solution, it will not help me. Self doesn't help me. In fact, self is my problem. Me. He said if I got some self-confidence, then I could feel better and do better and succeed at life. He said that I suffered from an impulsive nature, that's instant gratification, and with that came a short attention span. Later on, the doctor called that irritable, restless, and discontented. And he said that I suffered from a poor self-image. That means I did not like who I was. I hated myself. That's why I didn't do better. Now, I got to tell you, he was a well-meaning man, but you tell a kid my age, and like I said, at that age, I was 16. I believe I said that. I didn't know what to do with it, so I went and smoked some more non-habit forming marijuana. I mean, it didn't make a hill of beans to me. It meant a lot to my parents who suffered from my problem. And they did not know what the solution was, and they were grasping at straws. So I came up with something to make me feel better, and what I decided to do is I would work on myself to be cool. Because I didn't feel like I was cool enough to be with the cool crowd in high school, and the cool crowd to me is what they labeled burnouts. Okay? So what I did is I grew my hair real long, and I had a ponytail, and I got me some shades, and I got me a green jacket out of the surplus store with a sergeant stripe and some holes in it, got me a bottle of Visine, made sure it's half empty and it's poking out. I got me some faded jeans with holes on it, and some of them old motorcycle boots with the round things on the side and didn't look like they'd been polished in 10 years, and they had a hole or two in it. Because you don't have anything new when you're cool, at least in that day and age. Nowadays, it seems like new is cool. But back then, you need to have old hardware, all right? And I spent a long time in the mirror downstairs, and I didn't put a lot into homework, but I put a lot into being cool. I got my facial just right in the mirror. And I learned, too, that when you're cool, you don't say a lot. And when you get to school, you go hang out instead of go to the first class. And you smoke some non-habit forming. And then you say things like, "Wow, man. Oh, that's some good stuff. Can we cop any more of that, man?" And you spend your whole day like that. And going to school and getting an education wasn't cool for me. It just didn't fit in. I heard the stories from the guys that came out of the detention center and the juvies and all that kind of stuff. And that seemed more attractive to me. Now, was I sick? Alright? Problem with this, didn't know I was. I thought everybody else was, even at that age. You know, and that seemed very exciting to me. The guys came back with tattoos. They'd have Ozzy on their fingers. Now, my father was career Air Force. I didn't dare go home and put that, you know. But they had that kind of stuff, you know. And they got the earring in their ear and all that. And I really wanted to do that. I'm telling you. It seemed very exciting and a place that I could fit in because I certainly felt inadequate in a crowd that was doing well in life. And that was kind of my crowd of people. My father was career military. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He didn't think I was real cool. Okay? In fact, the term loser more than once was verbalized from my father to me. And I got quite acquainted with the term loser, con artist, bum, you won't amount to nothing. And I hated my father for that. You know, and I think that's the only tools he had in his arsenal because he loved me to death and he didn't know how to deal with me because I was a troubled kid. So he sent me away. And he sent me to a camp for 2 years. Okay, I'm a high school dropout. And in that camp with well-meaning people that really, I believe, cared about me and had the best interest in mind for me, gave me the same diagnosis as the school psychologist. They told my parents in the conference that I suffered from low self-esteem. And if I could acquire self-esteem and feel better about myself, I could do better. And because of the low self-esteem, I suffered from a sense of lack of self-confidence. And if I could get some confidence in myself through challenging myself and succeeding, I could be able to be successful. They told me that I suffered from instant gratification, short attention span, impulsive nature, and that meant that my decisions were screwy. They were rapid fire, and there wasn't much forethought in them, and that's why I got in trouble and chose the friends that I did and did the things that I do. And if I could slow down that and pay attention and look at the bigger picture, I would do better in life. And they told me that I suffered from a poor self-image. That means it showed up with poor relationships with other people. And that if I could get better relationships with other people, I could be more fulfilled and get my personal needs met and make better decisions in life. Now, after 2 years in their program, they did a stellar job. I believe that I walked out of that program with everything the school psychology of them had to offer, and I had ingredients of all those things. I got a GED. I was in my first year of college. In fact, I got in before my graduating class in high school. And within 6 months, I had 2 drunk driving charges. Okay? Because I had the wrong diagnosis. It showed up like that. It looked like that, but it wasn't that. The problem with the spiritual problem that we deal with in Alcoholics Anonymous, which we call alcoholism, has the same symptoms and characteristics of all the major disorders in society. They're very closely connected. And if a person is not an alcoholic and has a solution to that and understands the spiritual nature of the problem and the spiritual nature of the solution, then I may get the wrong information from well-meaning, kind people that have my best interest in mind. And that happens to a lot of people. There's an awful lot of misdiagnoses on an emotional level versus spiritual level. I'm in the business. I watch it all the time, day by day by day. Sometimes I scratch my head and think, what are they doing? And other times I know exactly what they're doing. Good job. Give them some more. I always tell all the people in my care that, you know, it's not their fault you're on all that stuff in those places. You act like it. So don't go blaming society. They're just doing what they know. If you stop acting like that, you'll stop being treated like that. And you're going to have to become accountable. Well, whether that means anything to them or not, I don't know. But that's the message that I pass on to them. When I got out, my alcoholism seemed to go when I was 18 years old to 21, and I went to Frostburg University in Maryland, which was a state college. It went from 0 to 60, and the progression of alcoholism gripped my life like it never had. And there's an ingredient in everybody's progression that's exactly the same. It always gets worse. It never gets better. See, this is such a simple program for people. You know, well, what's a progression? Did you get it out of the dictionary? Did you read the book on it? Did you get the Gorski manual on it? Progression is this by the science. No, uh-uh. Progression in AA is it always gets worse, it never gets better. And that was the history of my alcoholism. It was a progressive illness. It was a spiritual illness by nature that was treated as emotional illness in society, and it didn't bear any fruit. Because the emotional problem of the alcoholic is only a symptom of the greater problem, that's because the spiritual problem doesn't get treated by the spiritual solution that AA has to offer, which is a fellowship in 12 steps. I learned that here in AA. I didn't get it before I got here. I'll assure you that. I got it from some drunks that were telling me this. I'm going to make a long story short. I'm not going to give you all the things that I did to try to control my drinking. I want to kind of sum it up, and I'm going to jump a little bit into sobriety here. Is that I could stop drinking anytime, any place, anywhere, but I couldn't stay stopped of them by myself, bottom line. Once I put alcohol in my system, I could not control the amount that I take. I ended up drunk, passed out, oblivion drinking, whatever. That was in the progression, too, because I advanced from drunkenness to oblivion drinking. Alcoholics know what a oblivion drinker is. Non-alcoholics scratch their head. Anytime you talk to an alcoholic, they go, oh yeah, I understand what you're talking about, oblivion drinking. You got one. So on May 4th, 1987, I had a job, believe it or not. I lost quite a few. Didn't have a very good resume. 11 arrests. I could just go on. Kicked out of the family house, no keys, nobody talking to me. And on May 4th, 1987, 2 men sat in office and gave me a second chance if I would either stay sober or go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't matter to them how I did it. They just required that I be sober, and I went to AA. I had already been to AA previously on quite a few counts with the handcuffs behind my back and with the court ordering me there, so I certainly had a taste of AA, and AA didn't turn me off. When I sat in the AA meetings, I always thought, well, maybe one day I'll be with you guys, but I still got some drinking left because I'm not as bad as you yet. You didn't turn me off. I just wasn't ready for you yet. It seemed kind of drastic. You know? So I got here, and the first thing that I had to do is I had to be able to identify, you know, as an alcoholic and identify with the stories in AA. Maybe it didn't happen in this group. Maybe it happened in Charlottesville or Richmond or wherever. And I went to a meeting every day. Probably skipped a few, but probably I'd say for the first 5 or 7 years, I sat in a meeting every day. And I'm not sure I'm not close to that sometimes now at my length of sobriety. I've just never found the occasion to cut back. And in that identification, I wrote down some things because I don't have the memory I used to have. Some things that helped me out that I could relate to. Did you ever hit a telephone pole and say it was a deer? Okay. Now, I went to an AA meet, and I heard a guy say that, and I actually did that. I brought the car home. My mom said, "How'd you smash it up?" I said, "I hit a deer." All right? She didn't look for the blood stains or anything. She wasn't a hunter. She just probably didn't believe me. But. Did you ever think the telephone pole was a deer? I swear, one night I really thought it was. Something ran out in front of me, but I collided with the telephone pole. Did you ever fill up on water and food before you drank so you could alleviate a hangover? You know, I heard that, you know, in the bar rooms. Eat more lettuce, eat more of this, drink more water, you'll alleviate the hangover. Did you ever see double and put one hand over your eye so you could see straight? Remember going down the road at 3 a.m. in the morning, you got a double vision, you put the one lie? Yeah, I started to identify here. Did you ever lie about your drinking and think you got away with it? Yeah. In fact, I lied so much about my drinking, I believed it. How many did you have? And to the officer on my fifth drunk driving charge, I said the first that I said always. I had just a couple. I didn't know he heard that from every drunk he stopped. I thought I was original. Did you ever think you drove better when drunk? Did you ever have the flu on Monday morning? That means you got to work on Tuesday. Did you ever get excited about thinking about drinking during the day? Yeah. Did a family member ever suggest your drinking was abnormal? Did you ever think you could control your drinking? When arrested, did the county jail serve as a hotel for a good night's sleep? I remember a couple times I felt good that I was in there. I didn't feel good the next day I woke up, but I felt, God, I can get some sleep now and not worry anymore. Jeez. Did you ever pick up a cigarette butt or two out of a cup of full of stale beer and drink it? That's the 2:30 in the morning when you ran out of the keg. Were you sad when you heard last call for alcohol? Did the bar clock seem to go faster the drunker you got? I kept looking at it. It's 12 o'clock. Good God, where'd that go? Did you ever think a morning drink was a good idea? Did you ever think that marijuana was a herb grown by God in nature, therefore couldn't harm you? So I identified in. And I got right into the steps. I took the steps off the wall, and I had an off-the-wall program, but it worked because I was willing to do it, and I took the energy. When I got here, I was very fatigued from my drinking. Now I know that was a fatigue from hopelessness. Again and again and again, always gets worse, never gets better, could never fully get out of trouble, and I was just really tired. In fact, I was so tired that I was willing to listen to you. You know, where before I probably went through one ear and out the other, just like it did with my daddy. But in here, you guys seemed to get my interest and get me to pay attention a lot more than other people did. And after meeting, after meeting, after meeting, after meeting, after meeting, I really did admit that I was an alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable. And it almost, when I look at it, was a no-brainer. It wasn't something I had to struggle with. It just kind of fit right in. And I believe what AA says is it took every drop to get me here, and I really do believe that. You know, I don't think I got here too soon. I don't think I got here too late. I got here just right when I was supposed to get here. And I was ready for you folks, and I didn't know it. I thought I came here for a job to save a job, but I was really ready for you folks. And I look back and I see that now. And I spent 18 months here, and I was physically sober, and by 18 months and taking the steps and going to all those meetings, had a few sponsors here and there, and you know, put a lot of time and energy into AA. You know, people say that AA doesn't cost anything except a dollar in the basket, but I don't think that's true. I think it costs an awful lot of your time. You know, it has with me. It does have a price tag on it. It's my time. And it has cost a little bit more money than a dollar in the basket. Speaker tapes, conventions, seminars, gas, you know, taking other people that didn't have money. You know, it has cost me some money. And it's been well worth it. Well worth it. And at 18 months, that drink, what you guys were saying that one day would happen, I believed it would happen, but it took 18 months, that I would go through a whole day and not think about drinking. And about 18 months, about a year and a half, I remember I went through a whole day and I did not think about drinking. And for me, that's pretty good for a guy that was over-absorbed in it on a daily basis. And now I've gone many days without thinking about drinking, but I remember that was a real kind of victory for Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I was like, wow, I went a whole day, didn't think about drinking. God, they're right here, you know. And somewhere along the line, the problem was just removed from me. You know? It just didn't exist anymore as long as I was doing these things. But I was having some unmanageability troubles. I mean, the physical sobriety was there, and certainly there was hope now and the confidence in the future. The job that I was fired from, they had promoted me twice. I was now a director, and I went up the ladder fairly quickly. And they started to believe me and started to trust me, and Father gave me back the key, and I was allowed on the property, and he even gave me a credit card if I needed it. And, you know, some really neat stuff was happening, but my life was unmanageable. And I had a real money problem. I came here pretty heavily in debt, and by the time I was here almost 4.5 years, I was about $28,000 in debt, of bad debt. You know, it wasn't like for a mortgage or anything good. You know, it was for cars and frivolous spending and excited spending and impulsive spending. And I just finally... I had got this sponsor around 18 months, Bob, who forever I will owe for changing my life and having an impact like nobody ever had. And I really just connected with the guy and couldn't kick it. And I prayed it to death and I worked on it to death and I went to meetings to death and I did what AA asked me to do and just couldn't kick it. It was getting worse. Couldn't stop spending money, and the bills were getting higher. In fact, I was probably owed more than I was making. That's not a good position to be in, you know. It's a stressful position to be in. So finally, I let the cat out of the bag, and I told my sponsor. I was embarrassed to tell him because he seemed pretty good with money and drove a nice car and all that, seemed to really have it together, and I didn't want him to think less of me, but I had to tell somebody, so I told him. He's a good man to tell. So I told him, I don't know if it was 5 or 10 or 15 minutes on the phone, but I told him what was going on. He gave me an answer that, and helped me to understand it, that's filed every problem I've had in the sobriety and has totally made sense. He told me if I were you, I'd keep spending that money, just like you kept drinking that alcohol. He said everything files the same type of obsession. Is that you're going to have to hit a bottom, you're going to have to surrender, you're going to have to throw up the white flag, and at that time, when you get that point, God will remove it. I said, when will that point be? He said, well, God will remove it. See, I got reduced to simplicity here, you know, and I was an intellectual giant that didn't amount to a hill of beans in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, one thing you guys have given me and a gift you've given me is that I got de-intellectualized. And he said, every problem in sobriety, like that money problem that you have, will follow the same course. He says, until it becomes unacceptable to you, God won't remove it because you're still holding on to it. And he says, you're going to have to get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I didn't know if that would be 1 year later or 5 years later or 10 years later. He said, I don't either. I asked him one time about the same problem about anger. I said, you know, when I was 10 years sober, I said, you know, I'm really pissed off at everybody. I'm angry all the time. I feel anger inside of me all the time. I said, I don't know what to do about it. He said, oh, don't worry about it. He said, a lot of alcoholics are angry all the time. So I said, well, when is it going to leave? He said, it may never leave. Come on, where's the hope? He was a great man, you know, because he never tried to bluff me, you know. And he never tried to give me total advice. He let me know it was going to be my experience. And the money problem, what I did after that is I went to my boss, who was a kind man. I'd made amends to him, and I asked him if he would help me out. And he said, yeah, if you surrender everything that you have financially to me, I'll help you out. So like a kid now, you know, I'm about 30-something years old. I surrendered my checkbook and everything to him, bank card, you name it, and gave it to him. He said, what's all your bills? I had about 15 of them. Some were financial amends. He said, we're going to pay them little by little by little. He says, there's not going to be much money left over for you at all. I was smoking cigarettes then. He said, you know, we can probably front you $50 a month. And he says, your finances are so bad, I'm going to front you a paycheck on top of your paycheck to start to help you out. And as we get into this, then you'll pay back that paycheck. He said, are you willing to do this? And I was at the point, I said, yes, sir. I said, I'm willing to do anything. I don't want to live like this anymore. And by the time I was 10 years sober, 11 years sober, I was out of financial debt. And haven't been back there since. It was a good experience for me. And Bob was right. When it becomes unacceptable to me, then I'm at that point of surrender and God can remove that. As long as I'm holding on to any kind of thing to it, then it's not going to budge much in my life. It's going to get worse. And I've seen my problems go like that. So when I was 14 and a half years sober, I got on a high horse. That means I got to two-stepping around here. Didn't even know it. And I've been a bit of a big book nut for a long time in AA. Nowadays I call it big book religion. I want to talk a little bit about what I got into. And I'm happy I went that direction. I'm also happy that I've come out the other side of it. It's been important to me. But I'd fallen into two-step, and I had the memory of the big book, and I knew the pages, and I had the highlighters on it, and I had the dates on it, and I knew what Bill Wilson meant, so I thought I did. You know, I knew the dictionary to it, and I knew AA started then, and I knew about Ebby Thatcher, and I just knew a lot of stuff. And you always remind me, self-knowledge avails us nothing. And that was probably the time I might have been sickest in AA, because I found myself alienated from the fellowship because people didn't do it right, you know, according to the way that I thought it should be done. Now, that was a sickness within itself that I couldn't see clearly till I started coming out the other side of this. At 14 and a half years of sobriety, my life was ticking pretty good. I owned a business with the two guys that had given me the probationary statement May 4th, 1987. We're business partners today. And I bought some property, and I bought some more property. I started really getting into big shotism, and we built a house, had a contractor come in, and that's where the problem started. At the same time, I got physically sick. I was, I was hitting the ground pretty hard every couple of months, and just, I can't tell you. It's like somebody's poured lighter fluid in my stomach and lit it on fire. In fact, one night I was coming back from Warrenton and I had to stop into the Culpeper Hospital. Imagine that. They laid me on a gurney for 9 hours. The doctor told me I had food poisoning. So that's what I thought the whole time. Every time it hit me, I had some rash of food poisoning again. So in that May, it was getting, you know, the contractor came and I was physically sick and I had entered into UVA and they pulled out my gallbladder. I say that fear and resentment got that one. They patched me up, and I was building a house, and the contractor, because I'd known him for a long time, I let him handle the finances, and he walked away with half the mortgage. And that really pissed me off. I got a really good resentment on that one. And it just was going downhill in every direction. There's no contractor anymore. I have no license. But since I've been talking to the guy at the GMAC mortgage on a weekly basis, and he thought I was a sincere and honest guy, he let me be the contractor of the house. He says, the first time we've ever done that. So I called in my AA friends that knew a little bit more than me, and somehow we got the house finished. It was a doozy. And because of that kind of financial pressure and all those emotions inside of me, I went and took it out on my wife, because I'm a spiritual giant here. And I knew the big book inside and out, and I take it out on my wife. And she wants a divorce, and we end up in a separation for 2 years. And she lives upstairs. I live downstairs in a half-completed house or three-quarters of a house. Had a guy at our business make him a $2.5 million mistake lawsuit that we had hanging over our head, and I thought, wow, this ain't bad for 15 years of sobriety. I went into a poor me status. Some people call that depression. AA would just say they're feeling sorry for themselves. I was. And it was brutal. And so society's traditional way of taking care of people ripping you off is to go ahead and sue them. So I go down to the local attorney who has a lot of clout in Buckingham County and hooks me up with the prosecutor, and we got the farm started and the evidence started. And I'm really sick. I got all this stuff going on. And I called this guy out in Colorado, and I told him what was going on, and I said, I'm at my wit's end. I said, I just don't know what to do. I said, I don't have any energy anymore. A lot of people are expecting stuff out of me right now. I just don't have much to give, tell you the truth. And my sponsor's a good sponsor. My sponsor lives in Nebraska, and he said, I want you to go to a meeting every night and reach out to drunks, whether you feel like it or not, because it has to be your primary purpose, not your emotions. And what he's saying is you're spiritually sick right now. And so I did what he did, asked me to do. And so what this guy said in Colorado after I explained everything, he said, well, kiddo, he says, you lost a pretty good chunk of change, but I assume that you're going to have to forgive these people. In order to forgive them, you need to drop the lawsuit and get away from them lawyers and all that stuff and walk away from it. Well, I'm about like you. It's kind of like E.F. Hutton spoke, you know. Oh, my God. Next day I decided rather quickly, okay, and they sent down the board of supervisors from Richmond that checked out the contractors, and you know, she was sitting across the table, and I just told her I'm not going to pursue this. I said, I can't in my life right now. I said, other people may be able to do this, may be the right thing to do, I can't do it. I said, I just need to let it go and walk away from it. I said, it's only money anyhow. And I said, I got to recover in my mind on a spiritual basis. I can't recover on a material basis. And I really did need to do that. So I walked away from it. And one of the employees that worked with me, he had the same thing happen. A guy ripped him off for $30,000. He pursued it for 3 years, got $30,000, one of his lots, and put him in jail. And he goes, ha, 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 ha. And I'm like, maybe I should have. But I think that forgiveness probably in the long run for me bears more fruit than that. And I do need to remember that, you know, that I'm recovering on a spiritual basis, not a material basis or what society thinks I need to do. I found my solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's never seemed to let me down. Well, I kept trudging, going to all them meetings and working out with the drunks and going to work every day and going to build my house halfway through the day and going back. Thank God I owned my own business and I didn't have to take off work. I could just go back and check it and back and forth, and somehow it just all got done. And you know, it's not like that resentment towards that contractor left in a day or a week. It was probably a year later that it seemed to subside some. And then now today, you know, really, I don't think about it a heck of a lot. I assume that if he walked into AA, I'd probably point him in the right direction. That's called step 9, but... Right. By the way, there's a step here. It's called step 9. And guess who's the recipient? I'm waiting. I know he's coming. I'm waiting. I'm going to step 9 him before I 12 step him. And you know what? I found out, and I think the rest of my story is going to clarify this, is I'm not much on acronyms. I think sometimes they make sense, but I did really like the acronym that I heard a while ago of FEAR, F-E-A-R, forgetting everything's all right. And that seems to be my problem. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, everything has always been all right. It's always worked out despite me, you know, no matter what it is. And what I had to find out is when I went into that situation and my life went upside down, so I thought it did, that I needed to put 10 more steps between steps 1 and 12 because I was two-stepping. I was living on step 1 and step 12 and not much in between. And I needed to get back there. And so I wrote an inventory at about 15 years of sobriety, and I call it the first time I ever wrote a personal inventory. It was not with graphs or charts or intellectual or anything. I just wrote it, and I wrote it for the first time like I'd never wrote an inventory, and I shared it with someone, and I took 6 and 7. I made the amends where I needed to make the amends, and voila. You know, it really had an impact on my life at 15 years of sobriety. Probably a pretty huge impact. As I was spinning out the other side of this, and whenever you go into something like that, that kind of turmoil in your life, the change will always be better when you spin out of it on the other side, though it doesn't look like that a lot. And I was kind of hanging on to this big book fundamentalism that I started to let go. I had to remember that AA was a spiritual program. It was not a religious program. And we're not in conflict with religion. We just have no affiliation. We meet in the churches, and they're very nice to us. And I get along with all the ministers in Buckingham County. In fact, we should not criticize that. But we are a spiritual program. And I was treating the big book like big book religion, the Alpha and the Omega. This is exactly. And it was probably the time in AA that I was closest from parting from the fellowship, because I felt like when I came here, you guys didn't do it right, and I did, and I was sick, and I thought you were. And I couldn't fit into general AA meetings because you didn't talk about the way that you should talk about the steps, and you didn't have the knowledge that I thought you should know, and you weren't doing it right. And, you know, when I took a look at that, I was embarrassed about myself. I mean, I was embarrassed. And I started to drift away from that and the groups that I'd helped formed. And I'm not talking about my home group. We've changed. We've certainly changed as well. We're always changing every 5 years, our format and everything, which I think is good. Because change needs to be welcomed. We just hold on to everything we know all the time. Sometimes we're in trouble. We have to be more flexible than what we think we need. We've got to allow change to happen here. And I started to look at it, and I was like, I don't think I want to be there. I'm glad that I went through it. I'm glad I have the foundation of the steps. I'm glad that I have all of that. But I don't want to be there anymore. You know, I just don't. The personal relationships that I had alienated a lot of people in AA with my wisdom and the way that I had talked to them. And I felt like a lot of times that I was going to meetings that it was a combat zone and it wasn't something I looked forward to. And again, as always, that, you know, like we've said many times in all of our meetings, you're looking at the problem, but it takes a while to see the problem. And I think I just woke up. You know. And what I started to do is I started to go to meetings that I quit going to and meetings that I didn't think did it right. And I started going to clubhouses all over the United States and the East Coast and Washington, D.C. and everywhere. And they did things differently than what I was used to. But I wasn't there to straighten them out. I wasn't there to tell them they were doing it wrong. I wasn't there to disagree with them. I was there to carry a message to the alcoholic, a message of hope, of tolerance, and one that would accept another person. I can't tell you what started to happen to me in the fellowship. I just cannot begin to tell you. The big book had become a bar between me and people. And the big book's certainly a very big part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not at all. I'm telling you what I did with it. Is it put me between me and relationships with other people. I needed to move it out. And I needed to get relationships with other alcoholics on a different level other than information and steps. I needed to help them with a more practical way of thinking and living. And as I started to get that, and I started to carry these groups, I started making friends everywhere. I started going back to these groups that I didn't like, and they didn't like me, and making the amends. I was down in Maryland one time. And this guy came up to me afterwards, and he says, "You're different." And he started crying. He says, "I hated you every time you came in this group because you made me feel bad about myself." And I said, "I was wrong." I hope that I can make that up to you. I said, "I'll keep coming to this group. Maybe we become friends." He said, "I'd love to go out and have coffee with you now." See, it's not what we say, it's how we say it. And it took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to know that I have to learn how to live in the fellowship, that we are a family, we're a community, we do have disagreements, but we got to learn to live with each other, you know. And we got to learn to be friendly with each other to a certain extent, you know. These hard hits and this hard line stuff all the time, I've laid off it and had just as much success, you know. And I was scared to move away from it because I thought people needed a hard line, they needed this, and if they didn't get that, they wouldn't get it. And it's not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, what I've seen now that's a little disappointing to me, and in some way people were following me for a long time, was that some of my big book friends are starting to drop out of Alcoholics Anonymous after 15 years because they weren't going to enough meetings. They were going to two or three meetings or one meeting a week or something like that. And it was not enough meetings to stay excited about this because we need other people. And people say, well, the book's about just recovering off of your relationship with God. Well, this is part of our relationship with God. And we're not in conflict with that at all. It just depends on how you look at it. You know, God created Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fellowship. It's 12 steps. It's all of it. We're supposed to use it. And the closer I get to the fellowship, the better my life is. In fact, I went from 4 meetings a week to now 6 meetings a week. And sometimes I think I'm about overdoing it, huh? I got a long time in sobriety, but for me, it's very important because I deal with a lot of people on a daily basis. I'm a co-owner of 2 wilderness programs. I got a girls program. I got a boys program. I've got up, as these programs grow, there's going to be 80 or 90 kids in both programs. I got 50 to 60 staff, sponsor a bunch of guys. I'm always in relationships. And what meetings do for me is they take the edge off of my edgy personality. And it almost puts, you know how, I don't know about you, but if you get away from meetings for 2 days, there's a shorter time in the emotions than when you go to more meetings. And when I talk about going to meetings, I'm talking about taking the steps too. I'm not talking about just coming here physically sober. That the emotions get a little bit more trying. And when you deal with a lot of people, if you're in a public job or sales job or something like that, and you're with people all the time, more meetings are necessary because they give you a break from all that stuff. They allow you to center back into a spiritual solution. And how many times have we said when we go to an AA meeting, we always feel better than we did before we came? And when you take that out into personal relationships, it means you're less likely to go off on people. You're less likely to say something quick that you feel bad about later on. You're less likely to make a rapid, quick decision that later on you regret you made because you made it out of impatience. And what the meeting does, it gives you an hour to settle down. My friend from California always said it was a speed bump in a fast-paced life. And it is. It's a speed bump in a fast-paced life. And for me, I've needed that. You know, because again, now I'm back in the whirlwind. Seems like every 7 years I hit some kind of increment. And I think since about December, I've had quite a few sleepless nights. We started another business in the wake of this economy, and it really was not doing well. And many nights I was thinking, why did I do that? Why did I do that? God, if we have to go down on this one, it's going to really hurt. Why? You know, and just I keep going to the meetings, keep going to the meetings. And what happens to me when I keep going to the meetings is I register more with God. And for me, the 11th step has more of an impact on my life than when I get away from the people. I don't know why it works that way, but it works that way for me. And one of the neat things about the 11th step as I started to read the history was that it wasn't, you know, when the 60s came with the me generation, the transcendental meditation took a different turn, where today some of that shows up in AA, which is fine. But it really wasn't about that. It was about, in the morning, kind of concentrating on a couple paragraphs or a page about God that was positive and then going into your day with it. It was certainly about preparing yourself to help out other people. There's a lot more to that. But one of the ingredients was to read some spiritual literature in the morning, enough that your mind could grasp and take that with you through the day. And the more that I do that, it seems the better that my day goes. And so, a lot of sleepless nights there. And then this fire started in April, and it burned 600 acres and didn't hardly touch our property, which I was real happy with at the time. In fact, it looked like it was going to burn down the school, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the wind blew north and blew the fire away from the school, which I was very thankful of. You know, again, I got to remember, fear is forgetting everything's all right. You know, and I've been mighty scared before here. And I believe fear and faith exist in the same mind. They're not separate. I can be full of fear. I need to act like I have faith. Show up at the meeting and things change. You know, that's how I look at it. You know, it's not an intellectual puzzle there. Well, about a month later, the fire investigators came and said it was our fault somebody did it. And what they accused us of was, it was kind of nutty to us because really what they were saying never happened. And we let them investigate us and everything else, and they couldn't come up with anything. They're still knocking on our door. And I was thinking, I'm starting to get resentful again.